This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An aging stock of affordable rental housing in Bloomington Normal is causing ongoing tensions between tenants and landlords.
I feel like we get taken advantage of a lot of the times being low income. It hurts bad.
GLT's Judy Valente begins an investigative series, Landlord v. Tenant, and chronicles one mother's struggle to find decent rental housing for her family. Plus, Chasing John Coltrane, John Norton has more on a movie coming to the Normal Theater. And what is bocce ball exactly? Brian Bloodworth tells us. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An aging stock of low-income housing in Bloomington Normal is causing tension between tenants and landlords. Twin City landlords are cited more than 3,000 times a year for housing code violations. Because of their age, many of the rental units are in a chronic state of disrepair. Compounding the problem is that Bloomington and Normal each have only two housing inspectors to oversee more than 20,000 rental units. And there is little pressure on landlords to change. A 2015 League of Women Voters study found a more than 300% increase in the number of people seeking subsidized housing in the last 15 years. GLT's Judy Valente starts an investigative series today, Landlord v. Tenant, chronicling the odyssey of one mother trying to find quality, affordable housing for her family.
On the day Candace Gales moved into her apartment at 610 South Linden in Normal, she says she sat down on her front step and wept.
All you could do was cry. It's like, I can't bring my kids into this place. You know, there was blood splatters on the wall. The stove was years of grease just caked on. I had to take a gum scraper. I don't know what the painters usually use it. And scrape the grease like off of the stove. There was dust everywhere. You literally needed a hazmat suit to come in here.
Gail says she called her landlord, who had assured her the apartment would be cleaned by the time she and her four children moved in.
When I called the landlord and told him, I said, you know, I thought the cleaners were going to come in and clean and get everything ready for me. It's like, well, you know, I thought I was doing you a favor by letting you move in. You know, you explained you needed a place to stay, and this is the thanks that I get. And I'm like, I wouldn't let a stray dog live in these conditions, be in this apartment like this.
Gales' landlord, Bernard Dotson, declined repeated requests for an interview. He owns several low-income housing units. He's one of about 200 landlords countywide who participate in the federal Section 8 housing program. That program guarantees landlords payment of a portion of the rent they charge their tenants.
When we did move in, we got ate up by spiders. He ended up calling the pesticide people out. I mean, it was just disgusting.
Gales' story is familiar among tenants who must compete for a shrinking number of affordable units. A GLT review of Bloomington and Normal rental housing inspection reports shows many landlords who rent to low-income tenants keep properties in constant disrepair. Greg Trummel, Normal's chief housing inspector, says multi-unit rental properties must be inspected at least once a year. But with two inspectors to monitor nearly 9,000 units, it's a struggle.
There's a fairly in-depth list of things that we're looking for, but at the same time, it's probably a 5 or 6 minute inspection inside and outside the building. We're not operating every window, swinging every door. It's pretty much a visual inspection, and if, you know, we see obvious things.
Inspection reports obtained by GLT Radio through the Freedom of Information Act show Dotson was cited for numerous violations in the last 3 years, including leaking plumbing fixtures, inoperable smoke alarms, and missing windows in his units. Gales' monthly rent is $750, and she pays her own utilities.
Why do I deserve to be treated like this? Because I'm low income, because I have Section 8? Is that, you know, what it is? I like a clean house. I like pictures on the walls. This is already not to my standards, but I needed a place to stay.
Gales had difficulty with her previous landlord as well. She says her previous landlord refused to return the $995 security deposit. She was working at a part-time marketing position at the time, and the security deposit was money she was counting on to help her find a new home in Tennessee, where she planned to move after being offered a full-time job there. Emily Petrie, an attorney for Prairie State Legal Services, said she contacted Gales's landlord, Andrew Hollins, seeking to resolve the dispute over the deposit.
They were just really angry that she had moved out because they said she didn't properly give notice. And then asking for the rest and damages that really she didn't do. There were a few, you know, normal wear and tear things.
The landlord also reported Gales to the housing authority, claiming she owed him money. A complaint like that from a landlord could cause the tenant to lose eligibility for Section 8 help. Petrie says the landlord agreed to rescind his complaint if Gales agreed to give up any claim to the security deposit.
And our client wanted to accept that because she was ready to move on.
Hollins, the landlord, refused to speak on tape to GLT News. He said in a brief telephone interview he considered the matter resolved. The effect on Gales's life was significant. She did not move to Tennessee. She lost the job offer at a plasma company there. She and her children bounced around from place to place.
Without that security deposit, I was unable to move, so I end up living with my sister, who also has four kids of her own. So it's me, my four kids, my sister and her four kids, all in this one three-bedroom apartment that she has.
When Gales found her current two-bedroom apartment at 610 South Linden, she says she felt she had to take it. Her life reflects the hard-scrabble existence of many women. She became pregnant in her senior year in high school, then married her child's father. They had three more children. She says her former husband physically abused her and eventually went to jail. Gales obtained her GED and completed an associate's degree in psychology, which she followed by earning a second associate's degree in business.
And from then on, it was just like all about progress, giving my kids a healthy life from what they were used to seeing, being in that domestic situation.
Gales now works part-time as a cashier at a supermarket. The apartment she rents is part of a multi-unit building. Approaching her doorway, the first thing you notice is a missing storm door window. Inside, Gales points out ill-fitting plexiglass windows. To keep out the hot air this summer, she says she's had to constantly run her air conditioning.
My bill was $547 that I had to pay. I've been running my electricity like crazy to keep it cool, at least cool in the house, by the windows not being properly insulated and the doors not being properly insulated. I can't keep up.
Gail says she had to choose between paying the electric company and keeping current on her rent, which she is required to do to remain eligible for Section 8. When she didn't pay the utility bill, the power company turned off her electricity. Nor are those the only problems at her apartment. The tub leaks. The lights don't work along a stairway that leads to a below-ground bedroom. The water heater next to the bedroom flooded, leaving a visible watermark on the wall. A Town of Normal inspector earlier this year cited the water heater problem.
Our inspection revealed probably four or five what I would call fairly ordinary or routine code violations that needed to be addressed.
Trummel, Normal's chief of inspections, says the landlord addressed the flooding by fixing a valve in the water heater. But other issues Gales cited did not appear on that April inspection report, including a safety concern. The screen in the sole window of the basement bedroom where her son sleeps was screwed shut.
So if there was ever in a fire, he wouldn't be able to get out unless he had a drill sitting right there by the window to take the thing out.
Gales says she complained to her landlord. And she says she also called an inspector at the Bloomington Housing Authority. The Housing Authority oversees Section 8 units in both Bloomington and Normal. Kim Holman Short is executive director of the Housing Authority. She says her agency inspected Gales's unit last November and identified the bathtub leak. She says the landlord caulked the area around the tub, but inspectors were not aware of the other issues Gales cited.
If we see where the landlord is unable or unwilling to bring that unit up to standard, we will terminate that contract with the landlord and give the resident the opportunity to find another unit that meets the housing standards.
Informed of Gail's concerns by GLT Radio, Trummel of the town of Normal visited the property along with the landlord.
So at that time, I did, you know, walk through the unit with her and essentially asked her to identify what she felt were shortcomings.
He found problems that the inspection last spring had apparently missed, including the windows.
You know, I did observe these basement windows. The screens themselves were screwed in to the window jamb. The window itself was operable. Those were addressed, and the screws had been removed. So, you know, from our perspective, the window situation has been addressed.
Trummel says he directed the landlord to replace a circuit that had shorted, rendering the lighting fixtures inoperable in two bedrooms and a hallway.
So then he did engage a licensed electrical contractor to come out, and repairs have been made on that as well.
And Trummel says the landlord will be required to replace ill-fitting plexiglass windows with new ones, and he has to get a professional plumber to deal with the leak.
Time is provided for a property owner or manager to address these concerns, and then reinspections occur. And there's no question there's been some lag in getting some of these issues resolved.
But Gales wonders why pleas to her landlord went unheeded in the first place.
I feel like we get taken advantage of a lot of the times being low income. You don't have a voice, you know, and it hurts. It hurts bad because, yes, I'm low income, you know, I'm a struggling mother, but I go out every day, I work, I don't sit at home and rely on the government. I went back to school, I have a degree, and it just doesn't seem like it's doing anything for me.
Petrie of Prairie Legal Services says tenants sometimes move out rather than confront their landlord through the government bureaucracy or in court. And many times, tenants like Gales choose to endure hardship conditions.
Quite frankly, they have no other money, no other resources. They've given the landlord whatever money that they did have to start paying for rent, and there's just no other option.
The current shortage of new rental housing and quality affordable housing gives landlords a distinct advantage. It's a situation Holman Short of the Bloomington Housing Authority says isn't likely to change anytime soon.
Our community is growing, and the number of affordable housing is not keeping up with that growth. So, yes, we can certainly assist more families, more households, but the funding is just not there to support that.
Still, she says, protecting tenants' rights remains a high priority.
I would certainly say to any participant on our program that you should not minimize your value, and you should expect the same treatment regardless of your income and whether or not you are a participant of a voucher program.
But many tenants, like Candace Gales, say it is nearly impossible for those who don't walk in their shoes to identify with the fear and struggle they experience daily. I'm Judy Valente.
Tomorrow in the GLT series, Landlord v. Tenant, how a tenant complaint to a landlord and city inspectors is no guarantee of a quick fix. The story of a 13-day bathroom sewage backup and a look at tenant rights coming up in Landlord v. Tenant tomorrow.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, dedicated to providing comprehensive community-based cancer care in Bloomington Normal. The center gives patient hope through state-of-the-art technology and caring support services. Details at cancercenter.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the strategy of bocce ball. For the seventh year, the annual Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure will take place in Bloomington Normal, raising funds that make a difference in the fight against breast cancer. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of The Datebook.
The Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, Bloomington Normal, is coming up Saturday, September 9th at State Farm Corporate South Campus. Katie Parker is the PR Marketing Director for the Memorial Affiliate, and Rebecca Stiles-Berquist is the race chair. Both are breast cancer survivors, and as such, they realize just how important the race can be in raising money that makes a difference in the fight against breast cancer. Parker says at the Race for the Cure, survivors are in the spotlight.
Starts off at 7:30 when the race site opens. Survivors from then until race time can hang out in the Survivor Tent. It's sponsored by the Community Cancer Center. They're amazing partners of ours. There'll be a warm breakfast from Hy-Vee. There's certain raffles that'll be going on for just survivors. And there's also some chair massages going on and probably a few other goodies. So the survivors will convene there. And then stage activities, the announcement lineup starts at about 8:30, and 8:35 will parade in the survivors. And it's truly amazing to see all the survivors in their pink shirts. The crowd kind of parts, and you see all these pink survivors walking in. We'll have a local vocalist who will be singing a special song as they parade in, and we'll conclude the morning activities and get on the walk.
Rebecca, your race chair, what does it mean to you to actually be a part of the Race for the Cure?
Well, I'm very honored to be a part of the Race for the Cure and to be a race chair, being a survivor. I got involved with Susan Komen Memorial Affiliate last year. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in April of 2015. I actually chose to go up to Northwestern Hospital for my treatment. I was given options, and after genetic testing, the option that made more sense was a bilateral mastectomy with reconstruction. My reconstruction took almost 2 years to complete. So some it's right away and everything works quickly, and sometimes it takes longer. But by me doing the option that I chose, I was able to bypass the radiation.
So I understand that Komen-funded grants actually discovered the BRCA mutation that is helping millions of women.
It's amazing. I still get goosebumps every time I tell or think about this story. Our executive director has actually been with Komen since the Memorial Affiliate was founded. She was in the room with Dr. Mary Claire King when they made the announcement at the press conference where they said, "We have discovered this genetic mutation that is going to change breast cancer." And what that does, and for those who don't know what it is, I think many of us know who Angelina Jolie is. She's a famous actress who carries the BRCA mutation. She lost her mother, she lost an aunt, and I believe has a sister battling breast cancer. Angelina herself was never diagnosed with cancer, but she electively had the bilateral mastectomy because she did carry that gene. So by having that surgery and watching very carefully, women and men are able to make elective choices, proactive choices about their health. It really is amazing. And, you know, most young survivors, women diagnosed under 40, are immediately — we're going to be talking about genetic testing, you know, to see if there is a family history. Of course, talking about family history is very important. I know Rebecca has a family history, which is why they discussed the BRCA testing with her. And the importance of that not only will possibly change the survivor's trajectory of treatment, but also the whole family. You know, if you have one person diagnosed with a BRCA mutation, it impacts the whole family. The whole family can now be tested. It's a big decision. So people can choose to do that or not do that. And, you know, the great thing is it gives us a little bit of control over the next steps in our health journey. You know, speaking to the national and the global impact that the funds have, there are countless other funded grants that have made tremendous impacts to breast cancer as well. In fact, you know, breast cancer mortality rates have decreased by 30% since Komen was founded. So we hear often, why no cure yet? There isn't a cure. You know, we're getting closer. A discovery like BRCA is going to save thousands of lives. So we've decreased those mortality rates. We're detecting cancer earlier. And, you know, not only are we able to do that through the money that we raise locally that goes to national research, but we're making a huge impact locally as well. You know, there aren't many organizations out there that keep so much locally. Up to 75% of our funds we raise stay in our 36-county service area. So the Community Cancer Center, for example, is a grantee of ours, and their breast health navigator role is available to all breast cancer survivors because of a Komen-funded grant. And in the navigator role, as a survivor myself, my navigator really impacted my mentality and my emotional state in a positive way because she helped to guide me when I had questions, and she came and saw me in the hospital, and she made sure I had local Komen information. And that was all before I worked for Komen. So it's really amazing.
So, Rebecca, when you were going through your treatment and struggles with breast cancer, you had your family supporting you. But tell me about the support you have felt from the folks from Komen and all the people in Bloomington Normal who are involved with Race for the Cure.
I have felt a lot of support. I do have a great, great family support. They are my number one team. And Komen, I'm so privilege to be involved with them, because now it's time for me to get back. I am healthy now. I am cancer-free, and I can help guide people in the right direction that they need to go as well. I had someone who reached out to me when I was diagnosed. She had been diagnosed 3 months prior. She was kind of like my angel. So she kind of like helped me through all the questions and answers. And anytime I had a question, I could, you know, call her, email, text her. It was great. And then being involved with Komen as well. I mean, they are great too. I mean, we just, the questions all get answered. When you get that diagnosis, you completely feel alone. You don't know where to go. And with the navigator, like Katie was talking about, that is a tremendous help, having that navigator call you. When she called me, I remember a big sigh of relief off my shoulders, like, somebody's going to help me make a decision. Like, somebody's going to lead me in the direction so that I have all the information that I need to make the right decision.
So let's talk about the day of the event itself. Tell me about the various teams that sign up. Do they have interesting themes to their teams?
They do. You know, one of my favorite teams, I mean, they're all great, but, you know, we had Jamie's Rainbow Unicorn Kitten Crew. I know. And they dressed like rainbow unicorn kittens, if you've ever seen one. It was truly magical. And Jamie Wood is actually going to be a guest speaker at our Pray for the Cure event, which happens 2 days prior to Race for the Cure at St. John Lutheran's Church. And it's a non-denominational ceremony where we really encourage not only survivors, but the community to come together and just be uplifted as we get ready to embark on this race. So we've had the Honey Badgers with like a really cool cute badger on their shirt, and Team Pink, and you know, of course, Pink is running all over town on race day, and we love the names, you know, BFF, Breast Friends Forever. I mean, it's really a time to get creative. We provide a great race shirt with registration, but we do love to see tutus and boas and fun costumes. You know, it just, you know, there's a story there when you see that. You know that somebody has really been through something.
You know, you're kicking cancer to the curb, but you're doing it with spirit.
Absolutely.
So tell me, how much money do you hope to raise with the race this year?
$115,000. Yes. So we...
That's a lot.
It is. And we're able to grant about that much into the community every year. You know, so the participation is huge. You know, it's not just coming out and walking and forgetting about it. It's coming out and walking and knowing and seeing the survivors, celebrating the survivorship, remembering those that we have lost from the disease, and also meeting various sponsors and grantees, you know, people who are recipients of the funds and who have benefited from Komen-funded research. You know, some of us know exactly how we've benefited, and some of it's indirect, and, you know, like the BRCA mutation. You know, I don't know that many people realize that that was discovered from a Komen-funded grant, and it's huge.
Well, the race has only been in Bloomington for a handful of years now. Is it really getting bigger every year?
It is definitely growing, and that's what our goal is to get everyone out there, to get everyone out there on September 9th. Register today. There's some early bird registration things going on today that Katie's going to tell you about. Race day is so much fun. There's so much. The energy is amazing at race day. So we just want to see everybody out there.
That must feel really interesting because, well, when you're with the survivors in the survivors' tent, it's like an interesting community. Only they can really understand what you have been through.
That's one of the biggest things. Like some people, you know, people do, and it's so great to have people reach out to you and say, yeah, I hope you're doing okay. And I had a lot of friends and business partners reach out to me when I was sick, and they were all great. And it is nice to be around other people who have been through what you've been through too as well.
And you know, you can probably tell, but you know, Rebecca and I are pretty positive people. With that being said, there are definitely moments where you feel alone. Even though you know you're not, you know, most right. of us have friends or families that are, you know, that are around. There are moments where you just kind of feel that there's no one else to relate to. And it's so interesting through all the events that I've been to before I worked for Komen and at Komen and on race day, you kind of, when you see another survivor wearing a pink shirt, you kind of instantly feel connected to that person.
There's a kinship.
You know, I think even people that are shy are like, oh, I know, I've been there too. I've been through that, or I'm going through that. There is a sense of this instant friendship. And, you know, of course, we hope to not make friends because of that. But, you know, it's one of the perks of it is that you are going to meet and be surrounded by other people who know exactly what you're going through.
Well, at the day of the event, you have the 5K competitive run, a 5K family run slash walk, and a 1 mile family run walk, which sounds a little bit more doable for the likes of me. What else is going on?
We have a Kids for the Cure area. It was new to the event last year, but it's going to be bigger and better this year now that we have the Children's Discovery Museum on board. They're bringing out a dino dig and Alka-Seltzer bottle rockets for the kids to do. I think we're going to have a bubble machine as well. Something new this year is the buy one, give one registration opportunity. And what's unique about this is I can sign myself up for the race, but I can also sign up another individual. And what will, that is a survivor currently in treatment. So it's a donation of a registration for a survivor in treatment. As we know, the disease is, you know, it can be expensive to go through these things. And if we can, you know, give a little gift of participation, we'd love to do that. And we'll be working with our local nurse navigators and cancer partners to give those out. We also have Sponsor Village. So our sponsors and various community partners will be there giving out a lot of great, you know, goodies. We're so fortunate to have Kroger on board as well because they'll be providing a post-race breakfast. So there'll be breakfast for all.
Well, I do think that one of the reasons that I am so involved with the Race for the Cure is because early detection. Early detection is very important, and it is one of the messages I'm trying to spread right now. Early detection can change the whole story. So if you go get your mammograms, get checked.
They detected your cancer early.
Absolutely, and that's why I had the outcome that I had. So that is my message, is to go get your mammogram, and early detection can change everything.
And to add a little bit on to that is, you know, especially this past year, there have been so many confusing recommendations for mammograms, right? All kinds of different recommendations and what age, how frequent, and all of that. And I think what's important and what I love, you know, both personally and professionally about Komen is that we believe a man or woman should have access to a mammogram no matter the age. For example, if I, you know, I found my breast cancer at age 30, so I did not fall under normal screening guidelines, but I was concerned and I had a lot of pain and knew some things were going on. So I talked to my doctor and she said, yep, there's definitely something going on here. And together we decided, you know, at her recommendation, I needed a mammogram. And I had the mammogram, which detected my breast cancer. And that was covered by my insurance. So it wasn't normal guidelines. I'm not 40. I was not 40 at the time. So I just think that's so important. If you, you know what's normal now, know your body. If something changes, anything changes, just talk to your doctor about it, and together you guys can make that decision. And I think insurance companies are getting better about covering that mammogram, and if they aren't, that's where a large portion of our local grants go, is to organizations that can provide that free mammogram for someone who is uninsured or underinsured.
That's Katie Parker, PR Marketing Director for the Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, Bloomington Normal, along with Rebecca Stiles-Berquist, this year's race chair. The 7th annual Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, Bloomington Normal, is coming up Saturday, September 9th at State Farm Corporate South Campus. Registration begins at 7:30 a.m. I'm Laura Kennedy.
75% of the proceeds raised at the Race for the Cure stay local, while 25% go to national goals like new early detection technology.
Just survive. Oh, you will see me thrive. Can write my story. I'm beyond the archetype. I won't just conform. No matter how you shake my core, 'cause my roots, they run deep. So little faith, don't doubt it, don't doubt it. Victory is in my veins. I know it, I know it, and I will not negotiate.
You know that little sticker on fruit, how when you pick it off, it like damages the fruit?
And then trying to flick it off your fingers, right? And you're like, why does it have to be so hard?
That is design. And design affects everything around us.
And if done right, everything around us could be transformed to bring a better experience.
Ideas about the power of design, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, reminding families that September is Life Insurance Awareness Month. You can take simple steps today to protect what matters most, from your family to your business. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, a new documentary about the music of John Coltrane. John Norton has the story. Quite possibly the largest and longest running bocce ball tournament in the United States happened for the 69th annual time last weekend in the tiny central Illinois town of Toluca. Individuals attending the Chuck Rulinski Memorial Tournament had the opportunity to help victims affected by Hurricane Henry in the Houston area. GLT's Brian Bloodworth talks with Tourney Superintendent Tony Marie Woodke about the sport.
Bocce ball is sometimes fondly called Italian golf or Italian lawn bowling. It is a game where teams of two play another team of two, and they roll a wooden ball about 30 to 90 feet, and they try to get closest to a smaller ball called a polino or a bowling, and the goal is to get to 12 points. It's a game that's been in the United States at least 1700s.
I assume you get a point by getting kind of like horseshoes.
Yeah, so as my dad used to say, close and almost, but no cigar. It's just like horseshoes. So you have a team of two, and they will flip a coin and decide who gets to go first. Then one of the members will throw a ball, and then depending on how close they are, the second team may go or your team may go, and you continue to throw a bocce ball.
Tony, your family, the Chuck Rulinski family, has been involved in this for a number of years. Why?
Well, my dad was from Toluca, Illinois. He was very close to the individual that originally started it, who was an individual by the name of Lino Capone and Clicerio Capone. And he was very close to an individual named Cap Capone, who kind of was one of my dad's mentors. And my father's parents were immigrants. One was from Italy and one from Lithuania. So just naturally, he started playing it. He was a competitive person. And once he started playing things, he liked to organize and drive and take control. So when Cap gave him the opportunity to help drive it out, he jumped at that chance and was just passionate about keeping Toluca alive and vital, and it draws a big crowd to Toluca every year.
I was going to say, what's the highest number of entries that you had?
I looked that up, and the highest that we ever had was in 2011. We had 226 men's teams, 100 women, and 28 youth. And so you double that, plus if they brought a spouse who did not play or an additional child who did not play, it brings quite a few people into the town.
And it literally takes over the town, doesn't it, when they play? I understand teams are throwing the balls everywhere.
Yes. There's been a little controversy now and then. So basically, this is more of what I would call rogue bocce ball. We don't use the traditional courts. So they're allowed to play in most yards, along a lot of the side streets, in alleys. They are allowed to play close to the railroad tracks and by the Toluca Jumbo, but we always have a sign up that tells them not to play directly on the tracks. There are a few signs up in town that say, please do not play bocce ball in our yard. We do have rules about being respectful, obeying the law, and we do ask them to make sure if there is a sign up that they don't violate an individual's desire to not have them in their yard. So,
what makes it so big, do you think?
I think it's tradition, and I think that some of the champions might argue with me, but if you come with your family and you see people having fun and it's good competition, there's that chance to get a special wooden trophy that's a bocce ball on top of like a chalice. It doesn't take a lot of skill. So You can go buy a set at a local store for a very reasonable price and go out in your backyard and play. And so I think people see, there's been people that have won who've entered for the first time. And when people see that, they think, oh, I might be next year's champion. So they bring their families back. They spread it by word of mouth.
Actually, where do people come from and what's the furthest away that you know of?
As far as I know, I believe Oregon was the farthest. We have people come from Texas, Minnesota, a lot of the surrounding states. We have a large volume of Chicago teams come down. But the farthest that we've recorded, and my husband and I started recording this a few years ago, was the team from Oregon. We have a lot of people come from Peoria, Springfield. There's players that play in the Northern Illinois Bocce Association. They run a weekly tournament. It's quite a bit smaller than this one, but they play what we call the bocce ball circuit in the small towns around Toluca.
I'm Brian Bloodworth, and you're listening to Sound Ideas as we continue our discussion about bocce ball with Teresa Michaels, who is the co-president of the Northern Illinois Bocce Ball Association. Teresa, what is the lure of bocce ball to people that play it?
Oh, gosh. I think a lot of things. We actually had up until this past year, we had a priest that used to play in our tournaments with our association, and he kind of likened it in one documentary that was done to life. You know, sometimes you throw a ball, you think you know exactly where it's going, and then it just skirts off. And so, you know, life kind of takes you in 20 different directions, and so can a bocce ball. But I think just the camaraderie, the fun, the competition.
Sport on the rise, on the decline.
Ebbs and tides, I would say. I think it loses popularity and then it gains it.
What would you say the strategy of the game is? Obviously, you want to win, get your points to where you got to get. But as far as during the game, is there a strategy involved?
You know, I've seen it all. I've been playing about 28, 29 years, and I will tell you that when I first started out, I had no strategy. Even though I had watched my father play it for several years, I didn't really know a whole lot about it. And until, it's like anything, until you get in there and start doing it, you just kind of play it for fun. Obviously, you'd throw the pulino out, and then it was just kind of like bowling, pretending that pulino was the head pin. But instead of trying to knock it, you would just try to get as close to it as you can. Over the years, as I've played more and gotten more experience, there's certainly a favorite surface that some teams like to play on, typically, especially with a wet ground. A lot of men like to play on the grass because they can do what we call a lift throw, which is a backhanded throw high in the air. And if you have a decently weighted ball, it will come down and it'll pretty much stick. So if you have good aim, some of those men's teams are amazing with how close they can plant that ball right next to the little one. Women more often roll, so it is more like a bowling type of throw. So, you know, with that, a lot of times they do like more of like a court type of environment where it's a smoother surface. I definitely say there's strategy. I think if you talk to each team, it'd be a little bit different for everybody.
GLT correspondent Brian Bloodworth talked with Teresa Michaels, the co-president of the Northern Illinois Bocce Association. And before that, Tony Marie Woodke, the director of last weekend's Chuck Wierlinski Memorial Tournament in Toluca. This year's tournament will benefit the Midwest Food Bank and Houston Relief Fund. GLT will also be holding the initial Bocce at the Village event September 9th from 1 to 6 p.m. at Normandy Village, 1100 North Beach Street in Normal. The Bloomington Police Department hosts the annual Projects with a Cop event. That's Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Jefferson Street Community House. The event features opportunities for kids to build woodworking projects. You can find more community events at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to jazz legend John Coltrane and his classic song, Giant Steps. Illinois Wesleyan University jazz program chair Glenn Wilson is bringing the first big screen documentary of John Coltrane to the Normal Theater. Chasing Train shows on Saturday at 7 p.m. Wilson himself has played Barry Sax with the likes of Buddy Rich and Lionel Hampton and has toured with Bruce Hornsby, among others. He talks about the film and about John Coltrane with GLT's John Norton.
How has there never been a documentary on John Coltrane?
That's an interesting question, yeah.
Yeah.
There have been several biographies, of course. There's four or five biographies of Coltrane. No one's ever done a movie, though, and I'm not sure if it's because they didn't want to do a dramatization like the Miles Davis movie that came out recently or something like that, and this is really more of a documentary. So I don't know. That's a good question.
Have you seen the film?
No, I haven't. I've been trying to get a screener copy so I can see it, so I can plan the program around what's in it. But the interesting thing that I've read about the reviews is that it's more of a commercial movie for people who don't know jazz than a movie for jazz aficionados, which is going to be good in this case.
What is someone who is maybe not a musician, not a jazz aficionado mm-hmm. even, what can they get out of this film?
Yeah, they're going to get a lot out of this film because a lot of people talk about Train. He had almost a mystic quality to him, especially toward the end and after he found religion and recorded A Love Supreme. And he was very involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s. He died in 67, but in 65 and 6, he became a sort of a centerpiece for musicians in the civil rights movement. And at that time, his music was pretty crazy. It was getting pretty out there. So he had a very short recording career, really, from 54 to 67. But his music changed several times during that period. And he was always on sort of the cutting edge of jazz during that period. Of course, when he first came out, people hated him and they thought he was terrible and he played too many notes and he had a terrible sound. And there's all these, you know, early reviews of his music.
Well, there's even the story of when he was in the Navy. He played in the Navy band, and people say if you would have heard him back then, no one would have gone, boy, there's something there, right?
Yeah, I think he played alto in the Navy band.
So where does that come from, Glenn? How do you go from someone no one would say, this guy's going to be something, or I can hear something, to what John Coltrane became?
Well, he was in that seminal Miles Davis quintet with Paul Chambers and Philly Joe Jones and Red Garland, and they recorded a bunch of records in 55 and 56. Then Miles fired him apparently for drug abuse, didn't like his habits. But in 57, he got a six-month gig with Thelonious Monk at the Five Spot. Can you imagine today a six-month gig at one club? You're lucky if you get six nights anyway.
No kidding.
Anyway, that was really, I think, seminal in his development because Monk's music was very skeletal and he didn't comp a lot and he just kind of left things open. And that's when Train really started exploring the sheets of sound type of thing that led to Giant Steps and some of his 1959 recordings that were, you know, seminal in his career.
Glenn Wilson is who we're talking to. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. The movie is Chasing Train. It's playing at the Normal Theater on September 9th. And is this your nonprofit, Further
yes.
Jazz Inc.?
Yes, Further Jazz Inc. is my nonprofit. We produced last year the Thomas Chapin concert at
right.
the Normal Theater, and I thought we had such fun with that maybe we could do something like that again. So I received another grant from the Town of Normal, Harmon Arts Grant, which I'm very grateful for. And that's going to pay for the musicians for four concerts. We're going to do September, October, November, December. November. And hopefully the Normal Theater would like to keep this going after that.
The four separate films or just new
four showings? Four separate films.
Okay, yep. All right.
In October, we're going to do They Called Him Morgan, which is about Lee Morgan.
Oh, cool.
I'm going to play some Lee Morgan music. And in November, it's not set in stone yet, but I have the U of I Latin Jazz Ensemble booked. And we're going to maybe do the... what was that Cuban movie? The Buena Vista Social Club.
Oh,
Volume
yeah.
2 came out. Or some other Latin movie. There's a bunch of great movies about Latin musicians. But I really wanted to bring the U of I Latin Jazz Ensemble here because we have nothing like that in this town. And they're an amazing group of students that play their authentic music and led by Tito Carrillo, the trumpet player.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you an alternative to a question I asked you before about what can non-jazz aficionados get out of this movie. You play saxophone. When you first heard Coltrane, how did it hit you? Because so many people say, you know, it changed their lives.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. I think what changed their lives for non-saxophone players is different than for saxophone players.
Yeah.
And what changed for saxophone players...
Did it change your life?
Yeah, I mean, his playing, he plays more notes than anybody. He also changed the way jazz was played in the early days, you could only fit 3.5 minutes on a disc, so the solos had to be short. Later on, when albums came out, you would have four tunes on a side, maybe, of a 20-minute record. Well, Coltrane used to play one song for 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was just an incessant practicer. He practiced, the legend has it, that on a breaks he was practicing, and when he was in the hotel he was practicing, and he was always trying to work out stuff on the saxophone. So he was just an incessant practicer, and he spoiled a lot of saxophonists, I think. He sort of ruined it because everyone's... wants to be trained and nobody is, and so a lot of people play too long and a lot of people play too many notes because they think they're being trained, you know, and a lot of jazz historians look to his music and say that's kind of where we lost it in as far as jazz, when he started playing some of his avant-garde stuff in the 60s, late 65, 66.
People started following him into
people
that, those
started,
corners?
A lot of people started following into that avant-garde type of playing, and, you know, I was listening to Interstellar Space the other day, which is just him and Rashid Ali on the drums, you know. Well, it's a whole record of that. So I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, there is no one else I would ever listen to play this with just saxophone and drums other than Coltrane. The only reason it holds my interest is because I'm a saxophonist and I hear all he's doing and I hear, okay, you know, he used to say I have to practice 5 hours to get to something I don't know. So it took him the first 5 hours to play everything he knew, and then after that he could get to something new. So that's why he had to practice so long. But he was an incessant studier of the music, a very serious man. You know, most jazz musicians have a sense of humor in their playing. You can hear it. And Coltrane really did not have a sense of humor. He was very serious, very forthright, very upfront about what he was doing.
Was that his upbringing, do you think?
It could have been.
He grew up in the Jim Crow South and, you know, had to deal with a lot of different things.
Yeah, and I think wasn't his father a preacher or left his family early or something? I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I don't know. That's just his personality. And when you listen to him talk, I have on my website like 7 interviews with Coltrane that I've managed to call over the years, and you listen to him talk and he just sounds like he's very serious about his music. And, you know, people called him an angry tenor and angry sax player, and, you know, he didn't feel angry at all. You know, he wasn't trying to express anger through his instrument, but people
he was
a
just
lot of
intense
times heard that. Yeah, it was intense. Yeah,
huh.
And they heard it as anger.
And Denzel Washington voices the words
of
Coltrane in this film too. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Saxophonist Glenn Wilson, who's bringing Chasing Train, the documentary, the very first documentary on John Coltrane, at least visual documentary on John Coltrane, coming to the Normal Theater September 9th. You brought in Thomas Chapin. You referenced that earlier, the Thomas Chapin movie. Thomas passed away way before his time, as did Coltrane. And I don't think I asked you at the time. I think I asked the movie producer at the time, if Chapin had lived longer, where would his music be today? Let me ask you similar about Coltrane. Where do you think he would have taken music?
I really don't know, because he took it about as far out as he could in the short career that he had.
Would he have come back maybe a little bit?
I really don't think he would have. He's not the kind of person that would do what Miles Davis did, you know, when he came back with that at the end, the last 6 years of his life, playing pop tunes and things like that. I think what he might have done is maybe expanded into symphonic music or some other kind of music that allowed him to explore more sounds and sonic qualities other than just a quartet setting. He probably would have done a lot more writing and composing. Most of his writing and composing was for a small group or for, you know, quartet and stuff like that. So probably he would have gone into more into compositional aspects of jazz, but I can't imagine playing wise. It's almost like a perfect arc, you know, his career, and it ended when it had to end almost. So I really don't know how to answer that. I don't know what he would have done.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting to see.
Illinois Wesleyan University Jazz Program Chair Glenn Wilson speaking with GLT's John Norton. Through Further Jazz, Inc., Wilson is bringing the John Coltrane documentary Chasing Train to the Normal Theater Saturday night. Curtain time is 7 p.m. Following the show, Wilson will lead a combo through a number of Coltrane classics. This is Blue Train by John Coltrane. Find this interview and more music interviews with GLT's music podcast. Subscribe to that and the full Sound Ideas podcast at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the individual interviews from Judy Valente today, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. Let us know what you think of the show. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Thanks as well to Brian Bloodworth today. Tweet about the show as well. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.